At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Banks. You can love them or you can hate them, but this economy is not going to recover without them. Another Wall Street firm posted pretty good numbers today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargill.com/creates. And by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 16th of April, Thursday. Great to have you here. And if you're keeping track, today makes it three in a row for the banking industry. This morning, J.P. Morgan Chase joined Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs in having a very healthy first quarter, more than $2 billion in profits. And so on the theory that good things come in threes, we got some analysts on the phone this morning. We asked them whether the events of the week might finally mean things are turning around.
It's wishful thinking. I'd say my life could only get easier going forward if this was the first sign of a recovery.
Paul Miller is a managing director at FBR Capital Markets, one who is not sure the profits from J.P. Morgan and all the rest are going to last.
All these revenue streams are very volatile. They don't usually attract a good multiple to trading-wise because it's not really good, solid core income.
We talked to Peter Cohen as well. He runs his own consulting firm, and he reminded us of the mark-to-market rule change of a couple of weeks ago, the one that lets banks tell us how much their piles of mortgage-backed securities are worth.
I think we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here. I think, you know, one quarter of good results is nice. I mean, it's certainly better to beat expectations. You know, if they can sustain those results and if those results are based on real money-making as opposed to one-time gains or losses from accounting changes, then I think people will start to gain confidence.
Those bad assets and what to do about them were the real news that came out of the J.P. Morgan earnings announcement today. Didn't happen until about halfway through the conference call with analysts, though, when CEO Jamie Dimon said he is not going to be part of the government's program to help banks unload those assets, a program called the Public-Private Investment Program, PPIP.
We have no intent on using PPIP at all. We don't need it. You know, we have our own assets. If we want to sell them, we'll sell them. We mark them properly. If we want to buy them, we'll buy them. We're certainly not going to borrow from the federal government because we've learned our lesson about that.
Enough said on that one, I suppose. But seeing as how Dimon runs about the only big Wall Street bank to have thrived over the past year, what do you suppose what he said means, both for the plan having a chance to work and how other healthy banks might be? From New York, here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson.
If you want to know what happens when participation in a government program has a stigma attached to it, just look at TARP. All the participating banks want to return Washington's money ASAP so they can prove or pretend they're healthy. So by dissing PPIP, did Jamie Dimon doom the program? I asked analyst Dan Greenhouse of Miller Tabak.
Certainly by saying we won't participate participate in a given program, you as a bank CEO are making a statement to the marketplace, and correctly, that we are a healthy bank and we can go about our business as best as we see fit.
And the other guy's not.
Obviously the flip side of that coin is that the other guy is not.
That kind of a reputation could be devastating for a bank. Remember those mini bank runs last fall? Charles Gabriel of Capital Alpha Partners says J.P. Morgan's decision may be good for J.P. Morgan, but bad for the economy.
I think this presents a real dilemma for Treasury Secretary Geithner, who, you know, when he was at the Treasury Department in the 90s, watched very, very closely the lost decade in Japan. The problems that the Japanese had in goading the banks to disgorge themselves of bad assets.
Ah, bad assets. Jamie Dimon thinks we may be focusing on them too much.
I don't think toxic assets is the problem. I mean, you know, we hear this endless chatter about it, you know, but the banks who are in business are lending. But I also remind people, banks are 25% of the system. They're not 100% of the system.
Now, a J.P. Morgan official says the point of Dimon's comment was that toxic assets are dangerous, but it's the shadow banking system that's the real problem. The flow of cash through hedge funds and other non-bank institutions is frozen, he says. But Treasury says banks aren't doing enough either. A report yesterday says the credit being offered by the nation's 21 largest banks actually fell in February. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Moving on to the rest of the economy now, should you happen to stop at the mall on your way home to help stimulate that economy, you probably aren't going to notice anything different. But today, the country's second largest mall operator, General Growth Properties, filed for bankruptcy. It owns a couple of hundred malls, including Faneuil Hall in Boston and South Street Seaport in New York City. The company has about $27 billion in debt, and mall vacancies are rising. But so are opportunities, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
The nation's mall rats have been busy squirreling their money away. Shoppers are staying home, and traditional anchors like Mervyn's, Linens and Things, and Circuit City have vanished. Suzanne Mulvey is a real estate strategist at Property and Portfolio Research. She says to survive, malls are making themselves over.
They're trying to fill dark space, and they're going to look outside of their traditional group of tenants to try to find new users for that space.
Mulvey says malls are courting discounters they used to shun, like TJ Maxx and 99 cent stores. She says they're also leasing space to universities and government offices. And then there's entertainment.
Miniature golf, gyms, karate studios, skating rinks.
Spence Mell is with RCS Real Estate Advisors. He says it's about time the malls changed.
People are bored with what's in the malls now. It's all cookie cutter. This is a good shakeup to help bring some innovative retailers, innovative entertainment.
Things like the Flow Rider, an indoor ocean wave designed for surfing. It's now in several malls across the U.S.
Are you ready to get your flow on?
Mel says vacancies and lower rents have malls taking risks and new kinds of businesses discovering the malls.
One guy wanted to open up a mausoleum so people could come and visit their dead relatives and then pick up their dry cleaning.
In spite of valiant efforts like those, shoppers aren't expected to return until the economy recovers. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, banks led to a healthy bounce. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Today, as we retrace our steps from our Road to Ruin trip from last fall, we go to Missouri with Marketplace's Tess Vigeland. Back in October, Tess went to see Rich McCarty in his barbershop on Franklin Street in Jefferson City. McCarty's been in the stock market for years, and at that point, 6 months ago, he was taking the Dow's free-fall in stride.
I mean, worrying about my money ain't gonna do anything. It might give me an ulcer, then I have to pay a doctor. So I can't do anything. I don't worry about it.
That was then in a slowing economy. This is now in a recession and 3,000 points lower on the Dow. So we wanted to see whether the last 6 months might have brought on that ulcer. Here's Tess.
Still no ulcers in Rich McCarty's shop, Kai. Just some stray gray hairs on the floor from the trim he gave regular client Bob Sem.
I guess I am the only guy that does a shave in Jeff City.
McCarty's been a barber here in Jefferson City for 44 of his 61 years. Since October, business has slowed, but just a tad off and on. Nothing significant enough to make a difference at $11 a cut.
You know, in this business, people need a haircut, and they might skip a week, but I stay busy enough the way it is right there.
Some of the clients who aren't coming in quite as often are among the swelling ranks of Missouri's unemployed. The state shed 11,000 jobs last month, and the unemployment rate rose to 8.7%. That's the highest it's gone since 1983. As an example, McCarty points to the troubles facing one local car dealer.
Two of the car dealerships, they just taken away. General Motors wouldn't finance them. He was financing them, but none of the banks wanted to, so he just had to lay off 75 people around here. We've been hit hard in this area. Jeff said he hasn't. I don't think we've seen the bottom of it yet.
That's the vacuum. I don't have sleep too.
Back in the barber chair, 75-year-old Bob Sem insists the last 6 months haven't changed much for him. Sem is a 75-year-old retired accountant who now spends part of his days advising local investment clubs. Last time we met, he said he was 99% in stocks, and it was going to stay that way. I asked whether the market's wintertime collapse changed his mind.
No, I still look at individual stocks. I really don't worry about the market itself.
Did you take some serious losses?
I have a lot of down stocks that are down, yes. Mm-hmm. And I have some that are holding their own. I've been buying.
Sem says what's really bothered him, what's changed since my last visit, is all the government intervention in the economy, especially the auto bailout.
Let them go. If they can't make it, let them go. Where's Packard? Where's Studebaker? Edsel? None around. What makes Chevy sacred?
By the way, Sem drives a Chevy. McCarty has the same opinion about the bank bailout. Let the laws of supply and demand take care of things, he said. McCarty is also a member of two investment clubs, so he watches the markets closely. CNBC is always playing in the background as McCarty works his razor magic. He sold most of his personal stock holdings in late 2007, before all the real damage. He's holding lots of muni bonds now, partly in an effort to help the local economy.
I've got a few stocks, but I'm probably right at 10%.
And do you see that changing anytime soon?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, my broker told me I was nuts when I got completely out, but then that summer of last year, he said I was one of the smarter ones. If it comes, when I feel comfortable, it will all go back into it again.
The haircuts they've taken in the market haven't dampened spirits during haircuts in his chair. In Jefferson City, Missouri, I'm Tess Vigeland for Marketplace.
For all the promise the banks seem to be showing, housing is still playing catch-up. The company that watches foreclosure numbers, RealtyTrack, reported this morning filings last month were up 46% over March a year ago. Today, the Obama administration named the first six lenders that are going to participate in a $75 billion foreclosure relief program. But commentator and economist Barry Nailbuff says there is a cheaper way to turn things around.
The housing market is in a vicious cycle of scared buyers, foreclosures, and falling prices. In a normal world, falling prices increases demand and reduces supply. But today's housing market is far from normal. As prices fall, demand falls with it. People are afraid prices will fall further, so they hold back. No one wants to catch a falling knife. Paradoxically, falling prices also lead to increased supply due to defaults, distressed sales, and foreclosures. One way to break this downward cycle is to offer homebuyers protection against losing money on their homes. People buy insurance to protect against floods and fire, but they can't protect themselves from losing all their home equity in a declining market. With such insurance in place, many more people would be willing to buy in this declining market and thereby turn the market around. That's why we need this type of insurance now and on a big scale. What we need is a federal home equity insurance program. How would it work? If prices fall, you're covered. But the insurance is linked to the overall house price index at a local level, not the price of your home. That way, you can't sell at a loss just because you didn't maintain the house. Lenders would also be protected, with first claim on any payment from the policy. Protecting lenders should make them more willing to provide loans and help bring some leverage back into the mortgage market. Unlike other bailout programs, providing home equity insurance won't cost taxpayers billions. Here's why. Having insurance available changes the home market psychology. The very existence of the insurance increases demand, which reduces the risk that prices will fall. This makes the insurance cheap to provide. Indeed, if the insurance just stabilizes prices, there won't be any claims, and the cost of providing the insurance will be free. Can it be done? Yes. 6 years ago, my colleagues and I worked with HUD and Neighborhood Works to develop just such a product for Syracuse, New York. After nearly a decade of declining prices, this product helped turn the market around. What worked for Syracuse is good, even essential, for America.
Barry Nailbuff is a professor of business strategy at the Yale School of Management. You can share your thoughts with us when you get a minute. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, sunshine, margaritas, scuba diving, vacations, and more in Mexico.
99% of the people that go down there basically are in a tourist bubble. They're really not going to be in contact in any way, shape, or form with warring drug gangs.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials popped up 1.1% today, 95 points, closed at 8,125. The NASDAQ jumped 2.2%, 43 points, finished at 1670. The S&P 500 tracked up 1.5%, 13 points, ended at 865. Hewlett-Packard jumped 5% on news. It's now the largest personal computer maker in the world. A report from Nokia, or is it Nokia, saying demand for mobile phones is stabilizing, gave semiconductor companies a lift. Texas Instruments chipped up 4% on that news. Micron Technology rang up 10%. J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon may have sounded plenty bullish on his bank's prospects today, but investors were less enthusiastic. The stock ended just 2% higher. Citigroup, which reports tomorrow, gained 1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.84%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. And by DreamWorks Pictures, presenting The Soloist, starring Robert Downey Jr. and Jamie Foxx, in theaters everywhere April 24th. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone. Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The 5th Summit of the Americas begins. The focus will be on human prosperity, energy security, and sustainable development. The University of Michigan releases its preliminary April survey of consumer sentiment. And the 2009 X Conference gets underway. Speakers address exopolitics, governmental policy toward extraterrestrial-related phenomena. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a new face on Wall Street today. The language learning software company Rosetta Stone filed for an initial public offering, an IPO. That's when a company first offers its shares to investors. We explained it because if it feels like you haven't heard that phrase in a while, there is good reason. Only a handful of companies have dared go public in this bear market, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Maybe investors woke up to this commercial on CNBC.
So call now or visit our website and see for yourself why Rosetta Stone is the fastest way to learn a new language, guaranteed.
Some may have called in for the software, others called their stockbrokers. Rosetta Stone has had one of the most successful stock market debuts in a year. David Menlo of IPOfinancial.com says the company's stock offering was a hit, partly because of its marketing.
Basically, any time people heard about any foreign language procedure or application, the first words out of their mouth were Rosetta Stone.
There were other factors, like Rosetta Stone's profits, which had quadrupled since 2007. Then there was the stellar IPO of another company this month, a Chinese video game maker called Changyu.
They priced at the top of their range.
That's equity analyst Bill Buer of Morningstar.
And immediately skyrocketed on the first day of trading.
He says investors are just waiting for a good reason to buy. Changyu.com climbed 25% on the first day. That splash helped lure in Rosetta Stone and another education company, Bridgepoint. Again, Bill Buer.
I am not ready to say you're going to see kind of the floodgates open with a number of IPOs. I think you're going to see companies maybe think about braving the market.
He says it will be a long time before the market returns to the glory days of 20 IPOs a month. That was the average just a few years ago. So the smart companies may want to sit out this pool party for now. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
President Obama is meeting with his Mexican counterpart today in Mexico City. He and President Felipe Calderon will talk national security, the drug trade, and the global economic crisis all in just a few short hours. Then they will both head out to Trinidad and Tobago for a Summit of the Americas conference later this week. The U.S.-Mexico relationship is long, and it's complicated. Shannon O'Neill is the Douglas Dillon Fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Shannon, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Give us a sense, would you, of the state of the economic relationship between the United States and Mexico.
The economic relationship with the U.S. and Mexico is really quite strong. Since NAFTA came into effect 15 years ago, trade between the two nations has tripled, and it's the most important trading relationship in many ways for both countries, or particularly for states in the United States. So it's the third largest trading partner for the United States, and it's the second largest destination of U.S. exports. So it's quite important.
And yet all we have been hearing in the lead up to this trip by the president is drug violence, the prospect of Mexico as a failed state, how NAFTA hasn't really worked out for Mexico. How do you explain that difference?
You know, U.S.-Mexico relations goes through its patterns. And as happens in many relationships, you focus on the complaints rather than the positives, at least in the discussion. So that's really what's happening here. We're focused on the violence, which is real and has increased in the last several months. But in many ways, the real substance of the relationship and the positives fall by the wayside in those sound bites.
You know, there's some analysis out there from the intelligence community comparing a rapid deterioration in Mexico's domestic security situation with all this drug violence to the problems that Pakistan is having and the degree to which a Mexican issue on those lines would be as big a problem to us as Pakistan is. Do you buy that?
I buy that Mexico's security and stability is as or more important than Pakistan for the United States. Because our economies are so tied, because we share a 2,000-mile border, because Mexican immigrants are the largest source of immigrants in the United States, but there's a big difference between Mexico and Pakistan. Mexico is a thriving democracy. It has a strong economy, and it has a lot of things. It's really searching for stability and strengthening of its states and combating the drug trade. So in Mexico, we have a partner in a way that one questions at time with Pakistan. It's a much more uneasy relationship with Pakistan than it is with Mexico.
What's your sense of whether the United States is meeting its obligations in this bilateral relationship, both in terms of trade and the drug war and other issues as well?
It has to be a mutual situation. And so the United States is stepping forward on many of these issues. There's, of course, further steps that they could take, as well as the Mexicans. So I think right now it's between Calderon and Obama sort of feeling out how the U.S.-Mexico relation is going to develop. The United States is also now starting to talk about the guns that come from the United States, flow south to the cartels, as well as money that comes from the United States from purchases here of drugs and then down to the cartels there. And actually just today, the Obama administration announced that several of the cartels have been put on a Treasury watch list that will help in terms of seizing assets of the cartels and shutting down the businesses that launder money.
Well, what are President Calderon's obligations then?
Well, President Calderon's obligations there are to continue being a good partner on his side, right? So on the security, he needs to continue aggressively combating the drug cartels and really working to root out the corruption and other issues within his system. He needs to continue working on the economic side to make his country an attractive place for U.S. investment, but also to work through some of the issues and the tensions that we have on both sides. But so far, he seems quite willing to do this and has been taking steps that way.
Shannon O'Neill, she's a fellow in Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Shannon, thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure.
Reports of violence along the U.S.-Mexico border are just the kind of negative publicity that make the Mexican tourism industry cringe. So it's launched what you might call a counteroffensive. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gratch reports.
In February, the State Department put out a travel alert to U.S. citizens about drug-related violence in Mexico. The news media jumped on the story. Colleges told spring breakers to avoid heading south. Hotels in Cancun, Cabo San Lucas, and Puerto Vallarta all reported sudden drops in business. This just as Mexico was coming off a banner year for tourism. It needed American visitors to weather the global recession. Teresa Villarreal is with the Mexico Tourism Board.
Tourism provides employment to 1 out of 9 persons in the country. It provides 28% of the GDP.
The government agency put out the standard media alerts and billboard ads. It also turned to the internet. It set up its own channel on the video-sharing website YouTube, and it joined with tour operator iTravel 2000 to create a website, whatisreallyhappeninginmexico.com. The site featured former travel show host Scott Sheehan in Mexico, surfing, scaling mountains, and sipping cocktails in top tourist towns. He posted 90 videos in 2 weeks. In this one, Sheehan interviews 2 scuba divers in Cozumel.
You know that it's supposed to be pretty scary in Mexico right now, right?
Yeah, we heard about that before we came down. So.
No, it's great underwater.
When you were down underwater, you didn't, I don't know, see any gunmen or anything down there?
No, not at all. I'd say pack your bags and come on down anyways.
Yeah, me too.
The videos have been viewed more than 100,000 times. Scott Sheehan says his message is clear.
99% of the people that go down there basically are in a tourist bubble. They're really not going to be in contact in any way, shape, or form with warring drug gangs.
Producing and marketing Sheehan's videos cost just thousands. A traditional media campaign costs millions. Brad Miron is with iTravel 2000. He says before creating the website, bookings were down by 2/3.
The numbers of people booking to Mexico have come back, and we believe it's because they've been able to answer that burning question in their mind, is Mexico safe?
Other tour operators in Mexico have taken a different tack. They're running ads for Cancun without mentioning what country it's in. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, as you might have heard, John Madden retired this morning, which means watching a football game won't ever be the same. Neither, though, will a big chunk of the American consumer economy. Not only is the Madden NFL football franchise still the best-selling sports video game of all time, there are something like 65 million copies of it out there, but Madden was quite the product pitchman as well. There was a point where it was hard to miss his ads, and here is a list of just some of them. Ace Hardware, Outback Steakhouses, Verizon Wireless, Tenactin Foot Powder, Sirius, the satellite radio company, and of course, from the days of Less Filling, Tastes Great, Miller Lite. Make up your mind. Are we less filling? Tastes great? I don't know. You tell us. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 1.1%, 95 points, closed at 8,125. The NASDAQ jumped 2.2%, 43 points, finished at 1670. The S&P 500 put on 1.5%, 13 points, ended at 865. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast, a Cincinnati car dealer who's learning how to stay in business during the recession.
It has 215,000 miles on it already, which previously I wouldn't have been able to think that you could sell them that high.
One last dispatch from the road to ruin. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.